Hi, everyone. Welcome to a special edition of All Things Aviation and Aerospace. I'm Vince Mickens. With many of my shows, I usually have a panel of guests, but occasionally I have the honor and the privilege of, you know, having a aviation icon. And I've got one today who I'm really looking forward to talking to. He's a good friend and colleague and has some amazing accomplishments that you guys are going to hear about. And then we're going to have quite the discussion about advanced air mobility and unmanned aerial systems and all the things related to that and the subset of urban air mobility and everything, all related to Archer Aviation, who is paving the way. It's one of those companies that's making some real inroads with it. And, you know, the great thing about it is that this industry always has something new that's coming about at some point. And that's actually happening as we speak. And it's got the whole industry excited. I want to welcome Billy Nolan. Billy Nolan, as many of you know, as probably everybody knows, is a former acting FAA administrator. He is now the chief safety officer for Archer Aviation out in California. And they have the Midnight, which is a really exciting eVTOL that is in testing phase and getting ready to make some inroads into what is a rapidly growing industry, as I mentioned. So first, Billy, welcome to All Things Aviation and Aerospace.
Well, thank you, Vince. Thanks for having me on today. I must say it's a very much a pleasure and an honor to be with you.
It's an honor to have you, and you have quite the background. You know, it's always funny. You think you know somebody until you read a couple of their bios and dig into their background a little bit, and you go, okay, this guy has done a whole lot of things. And, you know, we've both been in this industry a long time, but gosh, your background, Billy, is just absolutely amazing. So one of the things we've been chatting in pre-show, but one of the things that I'm excited about is how much you have dealt with on the safety side of things, which I think is, as a pilot and a longtime pilot, that's just paramount to me. I mean, you know, you can come up with all kinds of innovative things and do all kinds of innovative flying and things of that nature, but doing it safely and without incident is key. So I can see with your background in particular why Archer Aviation was like, oh, we got to have Billy. Billy's got to have Billy. Are you done with the FAA? Okay, come on over. and that type of things. You know, I was thinking of something, and actually my wife is the one that's the reason for the thought. She said, you know, that stuff you're talking about sounds like the Jetsons.
Right.
It's like, yeah, George Jetson and Jane, his wife, and his boy, Elroy. For those who are young, they're probably going, the who?
Exactly.
The Jetsons, I did a little research on it, and the Jetsons actually came out in 1962.
Right.
Now, that's what I call forward thinking.
Absolutely.
Because if you look at, and I did, I went ahead and looked at one of the episodes just to bring back memories, and it's amazing how much I remembered about it. They only created 24 episodes, but it was so creative and so thought-provoking about what the future could hold in terms of basically advanced air mobility and the autonomous aspect of it. You know, these aircraft flying, you know, by themselves and things like that, and the automation. And I was like, okay, somebody, because if it came out in 62, that means somebody in the late 50s was developing it.
Right.
Our space program was still in development and in the early stages of it. So it just really, I thought, okay, the Jetson. Yeah, that's kind of the direction we're going in a modern sort of a way. Would you agree with that?
I'd absolutely agree. And so being a child of the 60s and beyond, going back, you know, picking up on your theme around the Jetsons, I can remember, you know, you had the earliest notions of AI to yours, and, you know, ability to walk outside and there's your, you know, what we call now a version of an eVTOL, speeds George off to work. And you've got other sort of autonomous things happening at the home, right? So, and that's that degree of forward thinking felt like it sort of, you know, six and seven sort of lost his way. Of course, the space race was on, right? And for anyone who is a student of aviation, you go, wow, when will we ever see it? And if so, when, right? And it'd be years on, but here we are. Here we are, what has long been talked about in the realm of science fiction is today fast becoming science fact. So this has come into life and it's unfolding right before our very eyes. So I can't think of a more, you know, while we can talk classic aviation and I'm thrilled by it, I can't think of a more exciting time to be in this sector of the market.
I would agree with it. I think this is probably one of the most exciting times really since space exploration began, which was an exciting era that we grew up in. And we were all glued to the TV when the Apollo missions took place and things of that nature. So absolutely. You clearly have a passion for aviation. So take us back to when all of that started. We were talking about, so you're originally from Birmingham, Alabama.
It's just outside a small town. Yeah.
Just outside of it. And so you were growing up there. So where did aviation come into the picture for you?
Well, you know, again, same thing growing up. No, you know, TV didn't come for a while, at least in our household, right? You know, working class, you know, blue collar family, working hard. My parents, I had, you know, a brother and four sisters. So, you know, eight of us. And so you found ways to entertain yourself. And for me, entertaining myself was with my then younger brother, paper airplanes, having fun, you know. But more than that, it was kind of looking out. You'd be outside. I was outside a lot. You'd be outside after school on the weekends. And
yeah, that's something that we all used to have to do, right?
Your mom said, okay, go outside.
Get out of the house.
Right. I'll let you know when dinner is ready, right? That kind of thing. So, but anyway.
Home before dark.
Totally. I would see airplanes and the airplanes flying over where I was weren't that far from different airports in and around the Birmingham area, right? And I'd see airplanes. I would hear helicopters that would sort of come up from, I didn't know it at the time, from other military installations, right? Huntsville, you had down at Maxwell and Montgomery, of course, Fort Rucker, Alabama, which was looming large, not as large as when I was a boy. But hearing all that, it kind of it's somewhere stuck in my subconscious. And I just developed this love of aviation from then. I kind of set it aside. I was born in Alabama, spent some time in New York. My family migrated to California in the 70s after I graduated from junior high school, went to high school in California. And in high school, I said, oh, yeah, I want to go to the Air Force Academy. I want to fly, you know, I want to fly jets. I thought that's going to be, I wound up, didn't do that, right? And I wound up joining the Army out of high school, going to college at night. You and I were talking just before we went live, and I became, joined the Army, warrant officer program, became a pilot, continued to pursue my education and all of that. And I flew in the Army, in my Army years, I flew helicopters, flew the Huey that everybody knows about. I flew the OH-58, the Kiowa. I started out in a little, you know, TH-55. I then moved on to airplanes. I flew the Super King Air and the King Air 90. And I flew for 13 of the 17 years that I was in the Army. I joined American Airlines in 1989 and started out as an engineer on the Boeing 727 and progressed over the course of my career. I proceeded to spend the next 26 and a half years at American, retired from American as an international captain on the Boeing 757, 767. I was an executive director of corporate safety and regulatory affairs. So this notion for safety, but I'll back up one step. I got my really start in safety, something that sort of stuck with me from day one. It's almost 40 years ago that I went to the Naval Postgraduate School and did their Naval Safety Officer course. And as I said, I was sort of smitten by the idea, how do you make things better? How do you prevent bad things from happening? You know, I would go on to get the Army Safety course at the Army Safety Center on the civilian side, University of Southern California, you know, their safety course, safety management system. So I've been steeped in it. And I was fortunate, Vince, to spend career at American Airlines, at Qantas Airways Group in Sydney, Australia, at WestJet in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And in all of those roles, I was executive in senior roles in safety and overseeing, you know, safety at the at the enterprise level. I left all that, did a quick hiatus for 3 months, joined the FAA as Associate Administrator for Safety, asked by the Secretary and President to move into the role of Acting Administrator when Steve Dixon announced that he was stepping down, and was fortunate to be able to again serve my country once again in such a critical role, leading an agency with 44,000 plus professionals. So it's just been, the arc of my career. I went through that in about 2 minutes, but it was...
trust me, we're going to talk about it. I was actually thinking, do I go Gold Navy or go Army? Because...
Army beat Navy, right?
The Navy graduate school program, but I'm a Navy guy, so
here.
I want to go back to paper airplanes, because you and I were talking about something in terms of young people, and you mentioned something that I think is kind of common. You had an interest in aviation, but you didn't know what you were going to do with it, and you didn't know where to go with it, and so it was years after the paper airplanes before you actually started finding some footing and figuring out, okay, I think I can go this route and things like that. And I don't think that's stands out by itself. I think that's actually quite common. And I think even in today's technology and all of the things that kids have available to them, I still hear the conversations about them trying to figure out what they can do in our industry.
Yeah, exactly. And it's it's a really critical point to make that you and I have talked about at length, not only today, but in days past, right? We have to move away as a nation from the idea of one initiative after another. Initiatives, as I say, it's like Baskin Robbins, there's 31 flavors, this one comes, this one goes, this gains traction, something else, emerges, something else sunset. We really need a very structured way of say, how do we, for those who have this sort of burning passion, or to be able to just introduce them to what are all the capabilities from, yes, everyone thinks of the pilot and folks thinks of, the mechanics and engineers and folks thinks of flight attendants. Exactly. But there's so many other specialties, from engineers to marketing to finance, to that makes not only the world of, airlines and corporate aviation work, but every other part of the ecosystem, from the FAA to NASA, et cetera.
And Archer
Aviation, which we're going to come to.
Well, advanced air mobility. Absolutely. Advanced air mobility has opened up a whole bunch of new opportunities. I mean, some of them are traditional engineering and things like that, but then there's all these other aspects of it, and it's high tech stuff. You're talking about going into autonomous flying and things like that at some point, and that has to integrate with the air traffic control system, which
that
in your front yard. So
that's right. That's right. Yeah. And I would say a quick point on that one, you're absolutely right. The motto at Archer is to unlock the skies. But I see that even, maybe on a deep level, I'm sure our CEO and founder Adam Goldstein sees on a deep level as well. It's the ability to unlock our imagination. So as we're thinking now, as you and I talked at the top of the hour, right, about what started with this notion of the Jetsons, is quickly becoming reality. And we're talking about entrance in the service in 2025. So you're just a year or so away from this, folks starting to see more and more in the early days, and maybe, a few of these, and then it'll grow in the tens and then hundreds and then, thousands and multiples of thousands. So, and all of this entire ecosystem, be it, we think of UAS, unmanned aerial system, drones, there are nearly a million drones in the nation's airspace today.
Right.
And if you look out and see what's coming, all of that is opportunities for engineers, is opportunity for pilots, but it's opportunities to connect communities as well. So that's potential, this is really happening. Yeah.
So you, being the former acting administrator at the FAA and before that, the deputy administrator for safety there, you've been able to look at the big picture of a lot of what we talk about every day and are experiencing and dealing with. When you're looking at it in terms of advanced air mobility and how that is evolving, and it seems to be the momentum seems to be picking up. I mean,
yes,
we've been talking about this for a number of years, but now as you said, it's actually in play. You know,
you're right.
Your midnight there for Archer Aviation is in testing phase and got yes. An FAA certification for approval for doing that. And is moving forward with that. There are other companies that are in yes. similar positions and things like that. So this ball is rolling.
It is.
And it's picking up speed.
It is indeed. And you know, I think for what's critical to understand for your audience, Vince, is they're what I call key enablers, right? That have gotten us to this point where, again, you know, I'll mention it time and time again, of course, at the hour, moving from science fiction to science fact, right? So number one is the battery. So battery technology has brought us to the point that we can now take an, you know, Archer's Midnight aircraft, a pilot plus four passengers and their carry-on bags, and be able to fly up to 100 miles at 150 miles per hour. And we know in a lot of cities, right, you may be crawling around at 25 miles an hour. So just to begin, you can just think of the possibilities.
Or 0 miles per hour.
Or 0 miles per hour for a long extended period of time. That's exactly yes. right. So I tell the story. I was doing a talk in New York, and I landed in Newark at 5:30 in the morning, clear customers. And I was curbside by 6:30. I had a talk to give in Tribeca. I got in my Uber that you do, everybody does millions of times a day. And it took me an hour and 10 minutes to get from Newark to Tribeca, right? Now, I could have, in midnight, that would have been about a 7 minute flight. Maybe it would have been 10 minutes flight, right? So you can imagine, right?
You're preaching to the choir with me on that kind of stuff, because I've had that happen so many times. And it is amazing. You know, yes. I know that one of the areas that, and I try not to jump around here, but we will anyhow. I know that Archer's sure. working, for example, at a Manhattan to New Jersey yes. routing type of a situation. Right. I know from recent experience multiple times that it's amazing to me that you can drive from Washington, D.C.
yes.
to New York and get there in probably just under 3 hours.
Exactly.
And then take an hour or more to go through the tunnel and across into Manhattan.
Absolutely. Just,
which is a really, if you look at it on the map, it's a very short distance, but gosh, it's crazy. So yes,
it's crazy.
Be able to do that in 5 or 10 minutes, you know, right. and do it with ease and that type of thing. I could tell stories about LA, and we all know about the 405 and all the other freeways yeah. there. And, you know, as a pilot, I actually would do things like fly from Torrance Airport on the south side uh-huh. up to Santa Monica or Van Nuys or Burbank just to avoid that hour and a half of traffic and do that exactly. flight in 15 minutes.
That's right. And so if you think, you know, I mentioned the batteries, the next one is just kind of having, you know, going back to the story, right, is let's imagine a world in which you can have something that contributes to, you know, zero emissions. So it's fully sustainable. It is fully accessible to every sector of the market. This isn't something that we will see, you know, some may think is the purview of the rich or the well, you know, the well-off, well-heeled, right? It is, and that ability to bring a product like Midnight to market, again, that unlocks the skies and unlocks possibilities for travelers. You look at our cities, are they getting any less congested? No, they're even more congested than before.
They're getting worse,
right? So our ability to contribute to that, you make a good point. I mean, we both talked about it. I live in Potomac, Maryland, and I'll look at the day when I used to go to my office at the FAA. I could, depending on what time I left home, that was either 20 minutes or 45 minutes and even longer. But, you know, I was absolutely. Typically in the office by about 6:30, 7
same
in the morning.
Thing going to the NBAA. Right. It's same
absolutely.
Thing. Going downtown could be a 20-minute yeah. or 25-minute drive, or it could be almost an hour, which is just mind-blowing.
Exactly. Yes.
What I was thinking about, Billy, when I was talking about your overview, too, is did you ever think, as you were running the FAA, that one day you might actually work in advanced air mobility for a firm like for a company like Archer Aviation?
No, not in the initial stages at all. In fact, when I came to the FAA, and I felt when I was asked by, you know, the president and secretary, I had arching three overarching goals in my mind, even as the associate administrator for aviation safety, but certainly as administrator, you know, number one was the continued advancement of aviation safety management systems, something I've been passionate about across the arc of my career for the last four decades. Number two was a continuation of America's global leadership around the world. We have been the de facto gold standard, and to see that continue when it comes to regulation, when a safety regulation, certification, how far we come in reducing the fatality risk for commercial aviation. And then lastly, I said, well, how do we enable the future? So I had in mind to think about how do we unlock this, what people are calling this new and novel sector of our global airspace system with eVTOLs and even drones, right? And I say, if we can do this, then you know what? Our leadership is sealed for decades to come, something that lives on beyond us. And so that was kind of my model. And as I was thinking through it, I had many opportunities. I got many calls. I still get many calls. And as I was, you know, decided that I was ready for my family, that it was time for me to sort of step away. I felt good, nearly 20 years of public service between the FAA and the military. I sort of looked around and thought, you know, about a lot of things. I had an opportunity to look at a lot of companies, and I really liked what I saw. All of them are good, but I really liked what I saw at Archer. I love the buzz. I love the vision of our CEO and founder, Adam Goldstein. I love what our people represented. It was, it's a deep bench with very experienced people from Tesla and Apple and others and Google and Uber Elevate. So I thought, okay, this is a place, you know, I felt the energy, I felt the vibe, you know, saw a viable path to market because that's really critical. One thing I've said a lot in the past is you can go to any aviation museum and all of them have some concept of model that never made it to commercialization.
Absolutely. That's a great
right?
point.
You say, well, that's a cool design.
That's a
cool
really
concept,
great point.
But no one ever has ever flown it other than a test pilot, right? So you really need something about marketing, you know, about bringing a product to market. And that's one of the key reasons that appealed to me about joining Archer.
So, you know, you and I, you were at the Global Aerospace Summit, which I attended, and you guys had the midnight there, which was awesome. As a matter of fact, I had to get out of your way because I was bugging because I wanted to know everything about it. And I sat in it and I inspected it like I was doing a pre-flight. And
you know, I noticed that.
but I was also impressed and pretty amazed with the things that Archer has thought of in terms of, you know, passenger comfort and convenience, the technology, just everything. The fact that the efficiency of the blade of the rotors and how that is, as an electric, as an eVTOL, is very quiet in terms of it when it's flying and things like that. So, seeing all of that and me personally witnessing it and getting the personal tour from you, what was it like for you when you guys moved into testing phase?
Yeah, when you move into testing phase, look, we, you know, one of the things that I think one of the defining differences between Archer and say others in the market, and there's a lot of folks, right? A lot of concepts in the pipeline, in the regulatory pipeline, right? But the things again that drew me was, many people will design an aircraft or concept or whatever, and then go in search of a market case to use that design. Ours was different, right? We decided to say, what part of the market? What's the outcome? What do we want to serve? Then how do we go build, architect, and design an aircraft that meets that outcome that we want to achieve? So sort of like, you know, the Stephen R. Covey habits of highly effective people, right? It begin with the end in mind. So that's really what informed you to go look back to our CEO and founder, Adam Goldstein. You look at our engineers and our CEO, Tom Muniz and Jeff Bauer, right? It's beginning with that outcome in mind. And so that's helped us, you know, get, you know, on our journey to certification and our journey to commercialization. That's what we kind of think through, you know, and just the other day of seeing, we've been flying Maker for a long time now. And having midnight flying to take flight, first starting in the hover phase, and we will continue to advance. Our team will continue to advance the profile through all of that. And as we march to certification, we're in the process of building six, you know, conforming aircraft, one of which, you know, will go to the Air Force for F-work for testing.
You're getting validation, you know.
Absolutely.
The DOD, the Air Force is, you know, you guys have struck a deal with them. The UAE, you guys recently have been working with them, and they're really looking forward to it. And, you know, they're very forward thinkers. So anything that's modern and, and jet setty.
I will tell you.
Right up
that's
there.
Right. It is. And I'll tell anybody if you, you know, I know you've been right. And Dubai Air Show is coming up here in just, you know, just under 10 days, right. Starting on the 13th is that what I would say, if you have not wanted a must see for me, and I've been there, you know, with my wife, is the Museum of the Future. And you look at the vision there, it says it's, I find it, you know, laughable, not laughable in a bad way, but in a good way, because they imagine a world of 2070. I said, 2070, this is happening in 2025, 2026, right?
Exactly.
At least kind of the first phase of it. But I appreciated the vision that you're seeing. It is very forward thinking. It is forward thinking in terms of how do we have a strong regulatory framework? How do we enable this sector of the market and be seen as a catalyst versus impediment? You know, I talk a lot about my safety background, but there's a couple of ways to think of safety. One could think of safety in a way that says, oh, it's safety. And that becomes, okay, stop the presses. Everything halts because safety. And you see it as either, we can't do X or Y versus say there is safety, but see safety as a catalyst and say, what must I see? What do we need to see as a regulator, as a company, or to the flying public to ensure that this will be safe? So we've architected, Midnight is a vehicle that has zero single points of failure. When you think about it, now I have nearly 4,000 hours in helicopters and thousands of hours in commercial airliners, right? So when you think about that, that means a lot. My Army days of flying a UH-1, a Huey, as everybody know it, you've got a two-bladed rotor and a two-bladed tail rotor, or main rotor, right? Either one of those fail, you're kind of up a creek there, right? But now you have a vehicle that's got 12 propellers. That is architected in the ways with redundancies and multiple redundancies built in the same way with our batteries. You've got, six battery packs that are supported, again, architecting ways so that you don't have any single points of failure. This is how far not only technology has come, automation has come, and all of that allows us to bring a vehicle to market that will be, what I say, once it's certified by the FAA and validated by others, will be as safe as climbing aboard a Boeing 787-900 or an Airbus A350-900. I'll just use those as kind of proxies, right? We really have come a long way in providing levels of safety, levels of accessibility, levels of sustainability, and everything else we kind of think of in this space. And this is really what the flying public has come to expect and will continue to expect.
Yeah. So your Midnight aircraft right now is set up to take four passengers and it's piloted. At some point, if I'm not mistaken, you guys are eventually moving towards autonomous flight. Now, there are a lot of factors that go into that, and maybe you can share that with us in terms of your perspective and how that's going to transition into the future, the near future, actually.
That's right. It's an excellent point, Vince, for both of us and for the audience at large, right? You think about it, right? Everything is about building that safe, first you got to build a safety case, and that's where certification comes in. Then you got to build the public acceptance or a comfort and confidence phase, right? So we think the way to do this, right? Let's start out with a pilot model. If we continue to build, we're collecting lots of data. And as we grow that, and you know what? It may not be, maybe it's 1 year or two, who knows what that time will be. We'll do it when it's right. But we've got good partners out there with Boeing. We've got folks who are going down this fully autonomous space. We just think the right space for us to be in is to start with that piloted model. It provides that level of comfort and trust to the flying public, and they will see, as you see more and more of these. Now, people don't think about it. The universe of helicopters globally is around 50,000. And most people don't give it other than the noise, they don't give it a second thought to say, is it safe or not, right? It's been certified, it's certified as safe. But it also has many, many, many multiples of single points of failure. So now that as we start to do this, and as we have the level of interaction with communities, with cities, with stakeholders, both at the federal and both public and the private level, you will come to see that we really have brought this to a phase and will continue to grow our system that we can indeed bring something that is super safe, that will absolutely, and I believe mind-blowingly, change the way we think about flying and moving around.
Yeah, so it's a whole new world that's opening up with it.
It is. Yeah.
Kind of going back a little bit and talking about the opportunities in the industry and things like yes. that, and where that's leading to. I think one of the things that I like to point out, I know one of the things I like to point out on my shows is to let the young people know you never quite know what your path is going to be. So right. if you think about it, if we go back and look at your career, you know, you went Army pilot.
Yes.
You went from, and I wanted to ask you about that because you went from helicopter to fixed wing. How did that transition happen before I continue with what I'm saying?
Yeah, so that's a great one. You know, of course, the Army, the bulk of the Army, you know, pilots are rotary or helicopter pilots, right? Just because right. that's the universe of how the Army operates. But it also has right. quite a significant number of fixed wing aircraft. In the Army, at the time that I did it, they picked about 50 guys a year, 50, when I say guys and gals a year. And so it was a very competitive process. At the time, I was in Korea in the 2nd Infantry Division flying helicopters. I was also the safety officer for the helicopter outfit I was in. And I submitted my application to the Army. It's a very competitive, you know, process for picking who would go to, you know, fixed wing school that year. And I was fortunate and blessed to get a fixed wing slot. And that the rest, as they say, is history. This was history, you know, 1985, 1986. And from there I went to Langley Air Force Base and was flying in a executive detachment there. And from there, you know, on to American Airlines. The transition was
you got the good duty, you got the VIP duty.
Well, you know, I certainly,
you
know,
I'm sure your wife probably like that. No, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been a buffered DMZ pilot. I've been in the Panmunjom on multiples of times, so I spent more than my fair share of flying in Korea and absolutely loved every minute of it. Right, so it was a wonderful the last duty I had before, you know, becoming a, you know, an airline pilot with American, and I still flew for another 3 years in the U.S. Army Reserve. So that was a wonderful opportunity.
I'm going to take advantage of having you on and ask you this question because I hear a lot of chatter about it, and I'm curious about your experience and opinion with it. Transitioning from being a military pilot to a civilian pilot, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, it's interesting there during my, at the time that I did American, it was what they call a 3-phase interview. Phase one, you came in, you did a little mini medical, you did a few tests, the battery tests and stuff like that to give you a quick overview. That was a big kind of screen out process, right? And it says you made it through that one. The next one was a little bit longer interview. You did a major medical, another one. And then if you made it through round two, you got to round three, you did your simulator ride and you did what they call a captain's board. And so came and did my simulator ride. I did my captain's board. The first question I got said, okay, you've been a military pilot for all these years. Yeah, who's been paying your salary? And this was the question. I said, well, you know, of course, the American public is paying. And this guy says, yes, you're right. And says, okay, you're here at American's paying salary. I says, you know, without missing a note, says, well, of course, it's our passengers. It's the passengers. He says, okay, of course, our crew, never forget that, you know, who's going to, but it gave you a sense, but that the transition from the military, very structured, very focused, very detail oriented, and coming to the airline, certainly American, I found exactly the same kind of environment around, you know, around decision making, around there was overarching. This is before the days of SMS, but you had other, you know, obviously safety models in place at that time, right? But being in it was equally structured because so many, I would say at the time that I joined American Airlines, probably 75 to 80% of American Airlines pilots at the time, I'm sure it was the same at Delta at the time, Continental and United, were military. They were either, typically they were Air Force, Navy, Marines, and right. Marines and Army sort of brought up the rear just because you had a lot of rotary wing guys coming right. from those two services, right? But you had, what you found yourself is having a similar structure at the majors, right? Most of them, their leadership teams, their training teams were all sort of model on military training in terms of what they provided, right? So I found the structure and my foundational training at the military was another key to my success. But we're also seeing universities pick up. They've long since picked up on that, and they're offering it. And with the advancement of safety management systems and human factors training that didn't exist in my early days in the way that it does now. So all of these things have contributed to not only incredible level of safety that we enjoy in commercial aviation, especially Part 121 and Part 135, right? It's because of the advancement in aviation safety system. It's because of the advancements in simulation, that level of experience and that what companies are doing today. And if we think about projecting to the future, as you and I said earlier on the show, is as we think of young people and getting them more involved, we have the ability now, Vince, to inculcate people, to train them at an early age. What does it mean? The greatest thing that we can teach professionals today is proper decision making, right? Because you will find yourself thunderstorm. You fly all the time. You know, you got a thunderstorm up ahead. You got convective weather there. You got this there. You got something happening. You got strong crosswind. You got all these sort of external things you're dealing with. And what is your ability to make good decisions in the moment for yourself and for your passengers, or for yourself if you're out flying in general aviation, right? And that ability to make good decisions is the key to safety. And it's the key to this, you know, as this new and novel sector comes to fruition in the next year or so. Yeah.
I'll be even more blunt about it. I think that's really critical. And I think this is the way I put it. If I'm up at front and I'm flying and there's a situation where it's a go or no go decision based on weather or other conditions or things like that, or maybe even something with the aircraft, there's nobody in the back that's going to pressure me to take that flight if it's not safe to do so. Exactly. As I always like to say, you can fire me because at least I'll be alive to find another job. So, and you'll be alive because I decided not to go. So,
that's right.
But I think that that's really critical. You know, while we were talking about being a military pilot, being a civil pilot, specifically airline, and of course, you and I talked about a lot of the other areas that are also available to fly, such as business aviation. There's cargo. Actually, cargo's a pretty great gig.
all of them are great gigs.
That's good flying, good money, pretty steady in terms of your hours and everything.
Absolutely.
You fly the same thing and that type of thing. But I want to circle towards or move towards flying something like the Midnight.
Yes.
What are the qualifications? Because it's kind of unique, you know. It's not a helicopter, but it's also not an airplane. So what do you guys look at that as you're, you know, developing? Yeah. You know, we're having.
So we talked exactly. So we talked a bit. I kind of touched on to the two of what I call the key enablers, and you've really, you know, thank you for this because it lands us on the third one, right? So the first one, what the battery technology has brought us away, is number two, to have a definitive certification pathway that we're all marching down. Number three, you needed an operational rule set, right? For something that, again, new and novel. The FAA initially started out down a path on the FAR Part 23, 2117A, which could be an airplane or a helicopter with a special conditions rating. And then they sort of thought through that and said, didn't quite fit the bill. So really then, you know, settled on 2117B and using the category of powered lift. What does it mean? You got something takes off like a helicopter, flies like an airplane, lands like a helicopter. Now, let me just stop and say, there are eVTOL models out there that have no wing. So they're purely sort of in a helicopter mode, if you will, the entirety of their time that they're flying, right? Sort of like a rotor. They're, you know, a rotor doesn't, the wing doesn't stop. I mean, the rotor doesn't stop and you can now sort of glide like, you know, you don't have that capability. Right. So using what the FAA calls powered lift and what EASA calls, the European Aviation Safety Agency calls special conditions, essentially the same, right? Something that's new and novel. So the FAA has written, they drafted a rule set. They put it out for a public comment. They've got those comments back. They're working through those. And they will finalize it. We expect them to finalize that rule by, you know, fall of next year. which kind of comports to our timeline of our entry in the service in 2025, you know, with our certification, et cetera. So this is something, so you asked the question, they're still working through that. I think initially the idea is it 100 hours over and above being a commercial pilot, you know, so that once that's finalized, and then the industry will absolutely have a concerted, definitive pathway for what kind of time and experience that the pilots will need who will be flying Midnight. But let me just say for young people out there, other people, doesn't have to just be young, right? We believe that Midnight and aircraft and eVTOLs like this, right, will offer another opportunity for tomorrow's pilots. Now, you remember I said, I got my flying in the Army. A lot of people go out and they'll get a Robinson R-22 type, right? It's probably one of, if you're on a cheap airplane, not that it's a cheap airplane, it's a great helicopter, right? But you kind of look at that, we know what the cost is. So now here's another pathway for how we help, contribute to growing the number of pilots that we have and that we'll need far into the future. You imagine a world, if we can go and replicate or be able to say supplant the 50,000 sort of noisy helicopter unit, you've got something that's all electric, 100 times, nearly 100 times, less noisy than a conventional helicopter, zero emissions, fully accessible, right? That's a new amount. We think, number one, it will be another area of interest for America's youth and for the youth around the world. But certainly when we think about, when we're talking about America, for America's youth, here's another avenue of how someone might get into the flying business and then could use that in as a springboard to the airlines or to, corporate flying, et cetera. So this gives us not only is it a lot of hope, we think it's a great pathway for, for America's youth.
Yeah, that sounds actually pretty exciting. When you're, as you're working through this, one of the things we talked about a little earlier are the importance of the aviation associations, the NBAA and the GAMAs and the EAA and things like that. As a matter of fact, we were talking about EAA and talking about Oshkosh, and it's one of those places where you're going to see a whole lot of everything that has to do with flying. And aircraft that you go, oh, that flies? Okay. If you say so. but also that in particularly in recent years has been demonstrating how aviation is advancing. And all of the type of different types of advancements in aviation. From your overview and from the positions that you've been in, what's your perspective on that?
I agree. People will go to, people will go to Burning Man, Coachella, and all of the, and those are all great things to do. And if you're a motorcyclist, people do a pilgrimage to Sturgis, because it's pretty cool, sort of like-minded. But I got to tell you, if you have any interest whatsoever in aviation, you owe it to yourself and to your family, to your kids, to make it
at least once,
because you make one, you're going to be hooked. I'm just going to say, you're talking about descending on Oshkosh, just outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 10,000 aircraft in one place. I was there in my role as the FAA administrator last year, right? And I got there, and the guy said, let's go on a little tour. I drove literally, Vince, 5 miles. 5 miles of wingtip to wingtip airplanes. Now think of that, where you can go and drive 5 miles. And so you got every permutation. So, and I take my hat off to NBAA and to GAMA and to EAA and to AOPA and every other sort of, if you want to say alphabet soup when it comes to association, because in one place you have America's best in, and not just American, but really you have the very best and the newest on display. And you got a lot of ancient stuff too, in a good way, and all of it's flying. And I was there, and there was nearly 675,000 people across the course of the week that I was there. So you think of that. So it's a major draw. And for aviation and for aviation geeks, I cannot tell you a better venue that I've been to. And I have been to Singapore Air Show. I've been to Farnborough, Le Bourget.
Exactly.
Headed to Dubai. It's the way to go. And if you think about it, it's a pretty cool event to attend.
Well, and a lot of what you see there, the aviation technology, you see they're working on engines and showing you how to take apart
That's
different
right.
types of engines and turbofans and the whole bit and things like that,
Yes.
or how to build a wing or how to build a propeller or how to,
Yes.
you know, just everything that you can think of, which again brings it back to, so this is the bottom line to me, and this applies to a lot of what we're talking about. Whatever your skill set is, it probably applies somewhere in aviation.
Exactly.
And, you know, for me to talk with a student who was about to graduate from the Pittsburgh Institute of Aeronautics, 2-year program, A&P license, you know, got certified by the FAA for the A&P, and got picked up by SpaceX. Who would think SpaceX was handling hiring mechanics? You know,
totally.
Generally when you think of SpaceX and all of the other, you know, Blue Origin, et cetera, and NASA, you're thinking aerospace engineering degree or something along those lines. You're not thinking, oh, well, I have mechanical skills and so that's what I want to do. You know,
exactly.
You're not thinking of it in that realm. So, you know, I think I can't overemphasize that, which I'm going to circle back to Archer Aviation, because as I was mentioning to you before we got started, I got a LinkedIn from Archer saying that they had 3 positions open for hire. So I clicked on the link, and then it went to the career site at Archer, and there were dozens of positions,
yes,
you know, and it was everything. Where's my notes? It was everything from engineering to, you know, systems
software
type of things and
yes,
software. Exactly. There it is. Staff systems engineer, flight test engineer, senior manager of supply chain systems, you know, the supply stuff. Hey, somebody's got to keep track of that stuff.
Absolutely.
And that's just a small smidget of it, but lots of opportunities. And this is just one company. This is Archer Aviation.
Right.
And yes, very progressive, and you guys are doing great things. And look at all the opportunities just in that one company.
Exactly. And what I would say to anyone out there in a, you know, it doesn't just have to be, for example, in aeronautical engineering or some other form. We have folks who've worked at Tesla before. You know, I'm a big fan of these brilliant innovators, you know, be it Elon or Jeff Bezos or Sir Richard Branson, right? Because this idea of thinking about what is the art of, what I love to say, one of my favorite phrases, what is the art of the possible? And you just got to, you have to ask yourself the question, what if? And so I'd say the same to someone who is sitting in university today and wondering, where do I go next? Or they're even sitting in junior high school today and contemplating, hey, what do I want to do with my life? Aerospace, aviation. I could go and, you know, occupy Mars, but that's a ways off. Before we get to Mars, come to Archer, is what I would say. And you will find, and what we are looking for, and I think everybody's the same, we're looking for people who are passionate, who have an all-in mentality that says, I want to go make a difference, and I want to be part of an organization, of a company that's really changing the future. And this is it's a global phenomenon. It really, really is. And this is, you know, this is what I would say. I want to leave you, this is what I call American's version of the space race when it comes to advanced air mobility, UAS. We can choose to lean into the moment. We can choose to own it as a nation, our leadership, et cetera. And it will be something amazing. I look back, I go back to the arc of my career making paper airplanes in Alabama to here I am, right, from the airlines, and here I am to the very future for everything else that's to come. I've been a pretty blessed person, I just got to tell you, and you have too, because we've talked a lot about both of our careers here, right? But I offer that up as a way, even if just a small bit of inspiration that says, you know, go, you know, see it. It is here. It's happening. Come be a part of it.
So from paper airplanes and the Jetsons to advanced air mobility and everything that's happening now. You touched on something and it stuck with me, and that's about the public perception and the public's acceptance of such new technology, you know, and like anything. But if people think about it, there was a time when flying from one city to another was novel, you know.
Right.
Something we take for granted now, you know, going from one part of the country to the other in a matter of hours is kind of a given. Being able to go from here to Europe in 8 hours or from here to China, I don't know, 14 or whatever hours, I can't remember what it is. But and actually being in on another part of this planet in short order is a given.
Yeah.
I agree. Go ahead.
No, please.
I was just going to say the advanced air mobility and urban air mobility and the whole thing of being able to bounce around cities or even between small cities that are fairly close to each other. We can use the Washington, the DMV, as everybody likes to call it, the District, Maryland, Virginia area.
Yeah.
You can do all kinds of stuff with that.
You can
bounce all over the three states, the two states in the district, with ease. And eventually that's going to be a norm. So
it's gonna be,
you having the overview, you having done what you've done with the FAA, you know, share your thoughts about that in terms of what the public is probably looking at and thinking about.
Yeah. So let's just use here. This is the hometown for both you and I, right? Here in the metropolitan area, Washington, the district, and Maryland and Virginia, right? So when I think about all of that, right? And I've flown out of all three airports, right? Baltimore. And you know, yes, we tout the convenience of Reagan DCA, but it has, you know, it has restrictions there associated with. But, you know, but think in not too long, in the very near future, that ability to, say, get from Reagan to Dulles and be able to do that in 10 minutes versus, you know, 35, 45 or even longer, depending on the time of day you're on 66, right? Or to get up to Baltimore, Washington, that could be an hour plus, right, on the Beltway. And so that ability to do that. So as we start unlocking that, I mean, when you imagine, you said it earlier, right? There are times it takes you 3 hours intra-cities. We've all been stuck on the Beltway. We've all been stuck in Manhattan or in LA and places like that that are just hours on end of sort of wasted productivity. And our ability to go unlock, will we unlock it all? No. But if you think about it, right, the uptake in EV usage, you know, the folks who are buying Teslas and GMs and Fords and Rivian and everything else. We're starting to see that level of uptake. Of course, we need the infrastructure to come along with it. And so what I would say on the public policy side to congressional leaders and government leaders is we need to change the narrative from, because today we'll talk about surface transportation, we'll talk about air transportation. I want to change, I'll create a new term, call it omni transportation. So when we think of electrification, we think of how surface connects to air and vice versa, right? This is the kind of, when we think about it at a national policy level, we've got to think about how we truly enable the future. And whether that be at the city government level, it's great to look out and see those forward-leaning governors, those forward-leaning mayors, right? And regional authorities. But it is all of us coming together that say, again, our version of the space race. We can either win it. I'll go back to China, maybe something in with my part. And so China just a few weeks ago certified their EHang 216 as a fully autonomous eVTOL that carries two people. Maybe we're not quite ready for that, but we don't want to wake up one day and we've ceded all leadership, right? That says we could have done all of that here, right? So let's make sure. That's why I say safety is a catalyst, not a crutch. We see what are the things that we need to see. Let's continue to work it. We've got brilliant minds, FAA, DOT, in the White House, at NASA, right? It is bringing all that. And I'll have to give a point of praise to the White House and to the president, right? They stood up the interagency working group, or the IWG, with the express remit to go out and say, how do we make all this happen? How do we bring it together? How do we eliminate the impediments and sort of the siloed effect between different governmental agencies? And let's move as one that says, you know, America's best days are ahead of it, not behind, and that we're not going to lose any ground to anywhere else in the world. And that's not taking anything away from them. But this is a space that we used to just own, right? And we just need to make sure that we continue to own it in terms of our national leadership.
Yeah. Before we run out of time, I do not want to miss the opportunity to talk about your new manufacturing facility that is being built in the Atlanta area. I used to fly in Atlanta and live in Atlanta, so I know that airspace down there really well. And I think it's really exciting that Archer has chosen that area for your manufacturing facility. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, one of the things we, again, going back to Zion, we said begin with the end in mind, right? But at, what that also meant is that we have, you know, we made a conscious decision. And certainly Adam and executive made a conscious decision. Let's work with top tier suppliers. We didn't, you know, well, there's no reason we're going to sort of do it all ourselves. There are a billion people. So we're partnering with folks like, you know, Honeywell and Garmin and Safran, right? In terms of, you know, the equipment we have on our airplanes and some of the systems. At the same time, one of our biggest partners, United Airlines, with their level of commitment and trust and faith in Archer. We partnered with Stellantis. So Stellantis is our major partner, one of the world's largest automobile manufacturers, is going to help us in this regard. So we are building this facility just to the east of Atlanta in Covington, Georgia, right? In their phase one, you know, roughly 650 airplanes with the ability to scale that up to, you know, 2,000 plus a year or so as demand continues to grow. So we're very excited. The leadership, we appreciated the leadership.
You're going to be hiring people in that market?
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, Governor Kemp has just been a, you know, been a stalwart supporter. You know, Senator Warnock has been a stalwart supporter of the entire, you know, Georgia delegation. So we've had this level of interaction for folks who see the vision, like mine, and said, let's go make something happen. And, you know, Atlanta, the Atlanta area is an exciting place and part of the country. And this is an opportunity, again, for America's youth and others with those skill sets, right? It's, we are excited for what it means for Georgia, what it means for Archer Airlines Aviation. I'm sorry, Archer Aviation, and what it means for America.
Yeah, and you're putting Covington Airport on the map.
You're here. Not a bad thing, my friend. Not a bad thing.
Not a bad thing at all. I think it's great though that you guys are doing that, and it just shows. And you just mentioned something that's really key to the collaboration, the different partners that you guys are collaborating with. That are not necessarily aviation, but they have certain things technology wise that make a lot of sense for what you guys are doing. So, and the fact that you guys are open minded with that and realize how important that is to help you achieve your ultimate goals.
Yeah, that's right. And I have to take a moment to give a shout out to one of our, you know, key executive, Tasha Perkins, who is also our chief people officer, very forward leaning, in charge of our partnerships as well. She's done some incredible work, spent a lot of time in the Middle East as well, right? So it's just having, you know, a strong executive bench that are out looking for these, how do we reach out? How do we touch base with some very forward thinking leaders around the country? You know, certainly Georgia rings large, and what we're doing in California is so much talent there in Silicon Valley. What we're doing around the world, what we're doing here in Washington, right? And we appreciate, you know, it's the opportunity for me to come on a great show with a, you know, a person I really admire and talk about not only all the things we're doing, but just, you know, this passion that we both hold dear around aviation.
Yeah, thank you so much. On that note, we're going to have to, first of all, thank you. I appreciate the comment. I'm the one that's thank honored you. Having you on my show. So, yes. But I always like to let the person, the guest have the last word. So any final words or comments or thoughts you'd like to share?
Well, you and I were together last year, and we were together and in Orlando, an NBA conference. You know, you had General Bolden and a couple other guys there. Great event. You know, I was struck then, as I've always been struck, by not only your passion for the industry, your passion for this thing around, as you said, how do we think about giving back to America's future? And for me, that's what it's about. I mean, I want, as I say, if this is the last third of my sort of, you know, physical life, whatever time God gives me, right? It is about how we enable the future. And it means a lot to me and to be in a country where all of that is possible. And we look for like places around the world. But this opportunity to reach out to America's youth and say, you can be a part of really bringing this all to reality, come be a part of it. This is fantastic stuff. And I got to say, it has been such a thrill being on with you today. And I really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I'm really excited about it too. And I just, we're at a point, as we've said many times, we're at a point in our industry right now. It's just blossoming
yes.
in so many different ways. It's growing exponentially. On the space exploration side, that's a whole nother, you know, realm there. But coming back to, you know, the advanced air mobility and the emphasis on that, and it's going to be quite the industry as it grows. So the opportunities are wide open, and we hope that the next generation pays attention to that. And we want to also give them some incentive to
go after
it, because it's,
I agree.
It, you know, they say it all the time. It sounds kind of corny, but the sky is pretty much the limit.
It pretty much is. Yeah. Well, you know, we are and beyond. So I'm still sort of a Buzz Light to infinity and beyond, right? It's just
exactly,
you know, it will just continue to grow. So,
yeah. So I know I'm going to see you at all the major aviation events and things like that, but I am looking forward to an opportunity for two things. So I'm going to put it out there. When I'm in Northern California, I want to come to San Jose.
Standing invitation.
Headquarters.
Yes.
And check out what you guys are doing there. And then it's going to be really exciting when you guys open up the new manufacturing facility next year in Covington, Georgia, there in Atlanta. So
love to have you along.
Forward to that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Billy. It's really great. You've had an amazing career, and you're still, you know, as they say, kicking butt and taking names. real proud of you and excited for you. And I think what you're doing with Archer and what Archer Aviation is doing as part of the advanced air mobility industry is phenomenal, and just looking forward to seeing that continue. So hats off to everybody there, the team there. Hats off to you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
Particularly on the safety front, you know, that's key for all of us that like being up in the air more than on the ground.
I agree. Thank you very much. Thanks, Vince. Thanks for having me on today.
Sounds good. Thank you. So you take care of yourself, and we will talk soon. And for all of you who are watching and listening to All Things Aviation and Aerospace, it is a video webcast and an audio podcast presentation of the Private Air Media Group. It is available to watch later on demand via my Private Air Media YouTube channel, Facebook page, and LinkedIn page. Also, podcast audio version is available Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. And as we say in broadcasting, to find out more, well, you have to tune in next week. In the meantime, please take care. Stay safe. Safe flying if you're a pilot like me, and blue skies. Oh, and Billy, thanks for serving. All
Thank
the best.
You, sir. Thank you.
Have a great one, everybody.
Thank you.